with Dick McGee on 27 February 78. So during the 50s and very early 60s, did you see yourself as a radio astronomer? Or how would you describe what you were doing?
Well, I suppose we'd call ourselves radio astronomers, but we're more concerned with hardware in this lab. This lab had a tendency towards hardware. People with a theoretical bent were looked on with suspicion, and I think this is why people like Kevin Westphal got out of the lab. Joe Pawsey was very much a practical person, mm-hmm. and he didn't, there was that side of it. There was the other side, and I think this is the Cambridge side, that thought that you didn't have to particularly have an engineer, an electronic engineer. If you had a crafty physicist, an amateur, then he'd do just as good a job of thinking and producing a machine, although at least he'd do the job that you wanted, rather than have an engineer say, no, we've got to stop, we're going to make this properly, we're going to make it really look good, and we're going to make it stable.
Sort of overdesign
and so on.
It.
Yeah. That didn't come until much later. There was nothing like that in the early...
Until the mid-60s or something like that.
Yeah. And in fact, first-class engineers, you see, Mills was an engineer. And he soon found that there was no future in engineering. Be a radio astronomer, mm-hmm. and then become an expert in astronomy. And that's how he went on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that in the 50s, there was nobody who was trained in astronomy in the lab. I think John Whiteacre was probably the first actual trained astronomer. There was no astronomy courses available in Australia, as there was. You have undergraduate courses, and had for many years in the States. We had nothing like that. And everybody just learned as they went along.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even up through the early 60s?
Right up to the 60s, I'd say, yeah.
And I've just finished talking with John Whiteacre, and of course he was telling me about the cooperation between optical and radio people that was fostered by Pawsey and
Bach. Well, Bart Bock, you see, came here. Bart Bock came here, what, about 56?
Something like that, right.
Now, he was tremendous. He had us down to Stromlo, three or four times a year. Mm-hmm. We had Stromlo people up here. He'd parade his prize student, John Whiteacre, and make him give us a talk. He was tremendous. And before that, I think there was this real opposition to anything optical. And we felt the optical people didn't want to know us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Bart who broke down those barriers altogether.
And did he inspire you to go back and more or less read up on traditional astronomy?
Yeah, indeed. Mm-hmm. And of course, he through having to go down and talk with these people and hear them talk about H2 regions and so on, we ought to read up and find out about all this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I feel that, there was a lot of lack of background knowledge altogether in Australian radio astronomy. I could be doing him a disservice here, but I just have that impression.
Well, that's interesting. One final question is, the up through the 50s, was Australia and England were, of course, the leaders in radio astronomy, with Holland having a certain effort in the U.S.,
sure,
but still nowhere near as large. What do you ascribe the Australian dominance and success to? What do you think were the key ingredients?
The key ingredient was Joe Pawsey. I have no doubt that it was Joe Pawsey. Joe Pawsey was in charge of the radio astronomy group. He was a very fundamental thinker. He wasn't frightened to ask an apparently simple question of anybody who came to visit us. The usual thing, you think, oh, I don't want to ask him that, he'll know what a bloody fool I am. But Joe had no hesitation in asking mm-hmm. apparently ridiculous questions. Often the bloke didn't know the answer.
But right.
He was in touch with every person in the group, and he was able to, he virtually directed everyone in his group. And then when the time came for results, he would be seeing what you wrote, he'd be saying, you'd spend a fortnight on a calculation, you'd be very proud of that result. He'd say, well, of course, it's useless, we'll cut this out. And
I see this in papers over and over, thanking Pawsey for assistance and so forth, and he published very little himself because he must have been spending all his time doing this.
Because his whole time was spent in contact with with his group, with the people, and he just spent it every day. Once a week at least he'd be out to the field station, and as I said, Dovahides goes off of there too often. And I think he inspired the effort. He had some very, very good people, of course. I think Mills, Christensen, Ruby Payne Scott.
Wild.
Wild, of course, and Bolton. It was just a very nice arrangement of bright people. And I think they gave it such a big foundation. Shane, of course, was very good too.
Do you think there was anything in particular in the way the CSIRO supported this, or was that only because there were such good people there that they were able to gather the support?
Well, the thing was that CSIRO were looking for some method of trading off these radar experts that they'd had, that they'd built up during the war, for something for useful for them to do, and in the climate of the 50s, late 40s and 50s, to have them doing stuff that might be appropriate to defence, so that developing receivers was thought to be a good
occupation. I see, so there was some in, justification of what was being
was
done
all,
here.
That was always the sort of the excuse, as it were, that you have to have for governments. Here's a group of skilled people that can be swung immediately over onto defence matters. I mean, we'd be horrified by this, particularly today, but that was the thinking in those
days. Well, no. But there never was any military money that came into CSIRO, though. Never any military funding.
Not at all. But it was.
And there wasn't any liaison.
The radio physics lab was set up for the express purpose of producing radar for the Southwest Pacific, and of course they had many U.S. servicemen, technicians working in the lab
during the war. So
that they were very much a defense organization in those days.
But during the late 40s and 50s, although this was justification used to the government for funding, in practice it never happened that there was any cooperation between the military.
I think that there were some immediate early successes in radio astronomy, and I think they were looking to, if there was to be any success in science, then they are prepared to back that. There doesn't seem to be, in those days, there didn't seem to be the opposition that there is these days to pure science.
Are you finding an opposition these days?
I think
people want to have practical results.
You see, the big deal now is our success with Interscan,
which is a microwave landing. It's an aircraft system, Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Well, I don't think it'd be very helpful to you, but...
Oh, yes, it will. That finishes the interview with Dick McGee on 27 February 1978 at Radio Physics in Sydney.